Hello. Welcome to our verse-by-verse in-depth Bible study with Bible teacher Dr. Bob Utley. Now, here's Bob.
Sometimes at funerals and sometimes at births and weddings and that kind of thing, it's kind of a verse that seems to speak of the appropriateness of time. But I think once we get into the context, you'll see it really has entirely different meaning in its context. The third chapter has almost got to be taken as a unit, the whole thing. And since we have several translations tonight, I think I want to give you several minutes for you to read the third chapter. Now, I want you to look at the discussion questions before you start reading through the chapter. And I want you to recognize that we have a specific context here. And the specific context is what's going to be very important in how we interpret this chapter. So look at the questions first, the discussion questions, and then read through the third chapter of Ecclesiastes in your translation. And if you have questions about words or phrases, mark them as you go through so we can talk about them. In reading the book of Ecclesiastes. Number one, it's the perspective, it's a satire, okay? You've got to realize he's talking about life without God every time he begins to talk about life under the sun. Vanity of vanities, I think anything under the sun is vanity. If you miss that perspective, you're going to be the most depressed person in the world for this book. Now, if you had to sum up in one sentence what this chapter was trying to say, one sentence, what kind of sentence would you write? Jerry, did you get one when you read through there? One sentence? Okay, if you had just brought it down to one essence, just one thought. Okay, time, appropriateness for time, okay. Terry, did you find something that you like? Okay, all right. Winston, do you see something there that you could sum up for us? One thought? Okay, transitoriness of this world, temporalness of this world. Okay. Linda? Okay. We saw that same thing in verse 24 of the second chapter, didn't we? That's going to be a repeated theme. Enjoy what you got while you got it, almost. Yeah. Okay. All right. Geraldine, do you see one there? Okay. Yeah, that's going to be we're going to have to talk about that. It's a very difficult Hebrew word there. Ha olam. What does it mean? I don't know. To me, the most important perspective of this chapter is summed up in a little sentence. God is sovereign. Man is transitory. Now, the reason that most people want this verse quoted at their weddings is because they miss what this verse is trying to say, verses 1 through 8. The whole context of Ecclesiastes is the vanity of man's effort. What 1 through 8 is saying is not the appropriateness of timing, you know, get your timing in with God's timing or strike while the iron is hot. It's none of that. It's God is in control and God has determined man's life. Now, that's what 1 through 8 is all about. And we see especially verse 10 and 11 where he sums all this up. Now, the second thing that I think we need to see in this chapter is, well, and any of you ever heard at a wedding, just while we're on this, wherever you go, I'll go, and wherever you sleep, I'll sleep, and your God will be my God. You ever heard that at a wedding? There's only one problem with that. You know what the problem is? That Naomi to her mother. Yeah, right. Ruth and Naomi. Well, that's kind of what this verse is. It's quoted a lot, but it's quoted out of context. So, let's look at this, if we could, for a minute. an appointed time for everything. Now, in the context of man's effort is futile, but God is in control, the context of this is that God has a plan for every man's life, and man can't get out of the guiding principles of that plan. Calvin would have loved this chapter. He would have jumped down, you know, shouted predestination, run around. It's just his kind of chapter. Now, notice, if you will, when it says there is a time for every event under heaven, some have seen this as the appropriateness of actions. But let me show you why it can't be the appropriateness of actions. How can man be appropriate about something like birth and death? How can we possibly fit our lives in the appropriate time? None of us wish to die, and none of us can have any determine we're going to be born, right? The last reason why this can't is because of the conclusion that's found over in 9, 10, and 11. 9, 10, and 11 set the framework for verses 1 through 8. Now, notice, if you would, please, when it says a time to kill. That's a strange phrase. Very strange phrase. What would be a time to kill? Now, it can't be war, because war is mentioned down in verse 8, right? So it's not a war. What would be a time to kill in God's plan? Well, as I thought about this some, only two things came to me to be appropriate. I believe the Old Testament, of course, believed in capital punishment. And a time to kill might refer to that, that some people deserve to die because of their offense against God or man. The only other appropriate time that I could think of a time to kill would be in self-defense or protection of your own home against marauders or robbers or something like that. There's no other appropriate time to kill that I could understand, apart from war in the Old Testament sense. Let me say to you that I've heard many folks claim to be pacifists, that they refuse to kill at all, you see. And they base that on the commandment of the Old Testament, thou shalt not kill. But just take my word for it, if you would, or get a Hebrew lexicon. The commandment doesn't say thou shalt not kill. The commandment says thou shalt not murder. Now, that means that those in the Old Testament understood some set of circumstances whereby taking a human life was not murder. War was almost a holy thing sometimes in the Old Testament, a war for God or something like that. And therefore, it's very hard for us in our cultural context to understand. In verse 5 down there, it says the rest of them are pretty obvious. It's very wide kind of paradoxes in life. You see where it says a time to throw stones and a time to gather stones? Now, that's been a real debated thing. Somebody said, well, it's throwing rocks in a person's field or gathering stones from a broken-down building to build new buildings. But the Talmud has a very interesting interpretation of this passage. The Talmud relates this to a sensual kind of pleasure, that there's just times that you just can't do a whole lot, so go out and throw stones, gather stones. Other times you can, you know, things a little more normal. So they relate this most specifically to making love. And the context of the next verse seems to almost go along with that. These things are almost in kind of a series, time to embrace and time to shun embracing. But yet that may be a little narrow. Don't understand verse 7, it says a time to tear apart. This, of course, is the Hebrew expression of mourning, where they would rip their outer garment and sew it back after so many days, and that fits. A time to be silent, of course, is an Old Testament allusion. Also to a time of mourning. In looking at this, I had a real struggle, because it looks to me like it's talking about there's an appointed time and man ought to get with it. But I want to give you some other verses, if I could, some Old Testament, New Testament verses, about the fact that time is in God's hand, okay? And I don't think I've given them to you anywhere there. Yes, I have. You see under appointed time for everything, number one, the word and phrase study. You might want to look those passages up later. It seems to imply that God has time in His control, and He'll do what's pleasing to Himself. Thank you. Now, verses 1 through 8. Jewish people understand those verses to refer to God's dealing with Israel, a national kind of destiny. And therefore, I don't think it is that, but just to say that's how they interpret this verse. Beginning at verse 9, we have kind of a conclusion of 1 through 8. What profit is there in all the work that man's done if God's got everything determined, if God's got everything planned out, if we're locked into a rigid set of circumstances beyond which we have no control. Well, in verse 10, it says that God has given a task to the sons of men to occupy them. Now, my question is, what is the purpose of this preacher, this co-leader, this professor telling us that our lives are totally determined? Well, there is going to be some purpose in it. Number one, we find it, the first part of it here, in verse 10, in the sense that God has given this kind of questioning, this kind of understanding, this kind of fruitless task to men for a purpose. And the purpose of that is found in verses 14 and also in verse 10, and that is that man might learn to be dependent on God. Now, really, that is the purpose of the Old Testament law as Paul sees it in the book of Galatians, that the law is a schoolmaster to show man's sinfulness, to show man's dependence on God, and to show man's need to respond to God by faith. Well, that's exactly what the preacher is kind of presenting here as. Your life is trapped. You're controlled by the destiny of a supernatural power. And you may think you have a lot of free will, but you really don't. And the reason that God has done that and seemed to lock you into circumstances you don't like sometimes, the wide expanse of from dying to being born, from planning to tearing down, the wide expanses of life, the extremes of happiness and sorrow, is that man might learn to be dependent on God by faith. And I think that's very appropriate when you see it in this context, what this man is trying to say. Notice in verse 11 it says, He has made everything appropriate in its time. Now here is the verse that to me shatters the theory that we should just strike while the iron is hot. It doesn't say man should act at the appropriate time. It said God has set everything in appropriate time. That's the context. God is in control. God is sovereign. And your life is under His control. Now, the rest of the little thing says He has put eternity in their heart. Now, the word eternity is terribly, terribly hard to interpret. The Hebrew word here is not used a whole lot, and it's never used in particular this kind of context. The King James has the word world. Do you see that, King James? I'm afraid that is very inappropriate. The way they get that is, this Hebrew word here comes from a word that means to be hidden. And some people think it's talking about human ignorance, that God sets certain times and man just can't understand it, that God has put ignorance or hiddenness in man's heart. Others think that man is like a microcosm of the world, and as man doesn't understand his own actions and can't really understand who he is and why he does things, that's where King James gets the word world from. Eternity comes from the fact of the word. The future is hidden to us. We can't know the future, and therefore God has put the desire in our heart to know the future, to know eternity, but man can't know eternity, and it frustrates him. If I had to pick a word out of all these that we've talked about, the one that I think is more appropriate is that God has put hiddenness in the heart of man. God has let man's mind search and wonder about creation and wonder about tomorrow. Man is the only creature that contemplates his own destiny, his own eternity. Man is the only creature that thinks about tomorrow and next year and has a five-year plan for his life and a lifelong goal. And as man tries to fit his life to go toward a certain goal, to accomplish certain ends, to do certain things, he continually finds himself frustrated by the circumstances of life. And so God has put a desire to know in our hearts, but God has kept us from knowing, you see. It's this dependence on Him again. Now, notice the next little phrase says, and yet man will not find out the work which God has done from the beginning, even to the end. He's saying you can't know everything about God. You can't understand why God is doing things the way He's doing them. The very presence of sin in the world, the very presence of evil and cruelty, the very fact that even though you're faithful to God, you still have a sin nature, are things that man can understand why God would do it that way, you see. So God has hidden His overarching plan from men's lives. I heard somebody today, and I forgot who I was talking to, maybe on the radio, something about You've got to trust God in circumstances when you can't understand how your circumstances are going to apply to God's overarching plan. And that's true. We've got to believe that our life is important and worthy and means something, but we really always can't always see that overarching plan in our lives and why God is doing certain things with us and through us and through our families and our friends. So we long to know what we can't know. I put a note in my Bible here, but thanks be to God, God has revealed something about himself. It's not like that we don't know nothing about God. Paul says we see through a glass darkly, a smoked glass. Now, if you ever looked at an eclipse through a smoked glass, it's not that you can't see anything. It's just you can't see everything. We don't have a detailed plan of God's plan for our lives and for our nation and for our world. But we know something about God, and the something we know about God is revealed in the Scriptures and supremely revealed in the person of Jesus Christ. So we're not totally ignorant about God, but yet we can't answer all the questions we'd like to answer. And therefore, we have to trust him for the overarching purpose. Now, verse 12, I know that there is nothing better than for them and to rejoice and to do good in one's life. Now, if I had to summarize that verse, it'd say, you can't change things. Why not just be happy with what you got? Now, that is going to be a theme that Koheleth comes back to over and over again. It's the same theme found in 2:24. It's the same theme found in verse 22. He's saying, I'm telling you, God's in control, and you don't know why God's doing it, and you don't know where God's going with it, and you've just got to enjoy what you've got. You've got to be content. Now, I think he's going to come back to say that this is a gift of God. What is a gift of God? Verse 13. Man who eats, drinks, and sees good in all his labor, it is a gift from God. Is the eating and drinking the gift from God? Is the labor the gift of God? What is the gift of God here? It's one of the discussion questions. Verse number 3. What is the gift of God? Excuse me? I think so. The same thing I would say, it's a perspective on life. Now, you know, you can get two groups of people, and you can bring them to the same circumstance. And one group, I guess the story about the two shoe salesmen in Africa is probably the best. You send two shoe salesmen to Africa. One of them says, cancel all my order, nobody wears shoes over here. The other guy says, triple my order, everybody needs shoes. Now, do you see the difference in perspective? It's the same set of circumstance, it's just the way to look at it. Now, that's the way Christians are. Some Christians get so down in the dumps and crushed and defeated over the things of this world, while other ones seem to let the presence of God buoy them and sustain them, even though they don't understand all and don't know why and can't fathom out God's reasons. The gift of God, as I understand it, is a perspective on life. Matter of fact, all my sermons, I preached about 3 times since I've been here in 2 years on Romans 8:28. Romans 8:28 is nothing less than, I think, God's perspective for man to view his world. Well, that's what this is. The gift of God is a faith perspective. I don't understand. I believe God's in control. I thank God for what I have. I'm going to enjoy it. And this is not taking away ambition. No, this is saying I'm going to be content in whatever state I find myself, and I'm going to look at life through the eyes of faith and not through the eyes of pessimism. So, now, verse 14, for I know that everything God does remains forever. Now, isn't this just the theme of the book? Isn't this what it's talking about? God's sovereign, God's works remain, nothing changes in what God does, but man is here today and gone tomorrow. Man's works are as a mist that comes up and is blown away. All that man does, he leaves to somebody else. Man's like a flame that flickers for a few moments of time, blows away, nothing's left, nobody remembers. Now, you see the great antithesis between what God does and what man does? Now, we've got to remember that in these particular verses, he's bringing God into the situation. So we don't have the sarcasm here that we're going to have a little bit later, beginning in verse 15 down, because then he's going to be talking about man without God. But in these verses, the last few we've talked about, he is including God in the formula. So he's including God, and he's still saying, "Woo, God is in control. I don't understand God. I think God does have a good purpose in life. I think God has given a good gift, but I don't know what it is." Now, notice if you would, please, when it says that, again, the purpose of all this, the answer to question number two, is found in the last phrase of verse 14. For God has so worked that men should fear Him or reverence Him. What does that mean? God put the desires in men's hearts to search, but God thwarts the search. God puts the desire in man's heart to know, but God veils the truth. Now, why? So man will know that he is man and God is God, and that we may trust Him by faith. Friends, I think sometimes in our systematic theologies and our study of the Bible and our great knowledge about God, that we think we know God. God is different. God is totally beyond our finite minds of knowing Him. Now, He has given us the basis to trust Him, and He has given us the basis to know that He loves us, and He has given us the basis of promises about how He'll deal with us. The day you think you know God is the day you've made a serious mistake. We never know God completely until we're going to see Him face to face. Now, we know Him pretty well in Jesus Christ, but even in Jesus Christ, we don't have all the answers about God. And still, God is different. So, and the purpose of all this is that man might trust God, fear God, seek God. The way when I preach on the New Testament, is that God has put a God-shaped hole in man's life. And man's greatest desire is to fill that hole, that need, that desire in his being. And he'll put everything in there. He'll put sex and drugs and pleasure and money and fame and activity and everything. He'll try to fit that hole that God's put in his life. That's what the preacher's saying. God has made you to want to know Him, and yet you can't know Him. To show man that man is frail, and we must trust God. Not know Him completely, but trust Him. Now, verse 15. That which has already been is that which is has been already, and that which will be has already been. Now I think that at this point right here I would say that what we have is an example of progressive revelation. This man's view of history almost seems to be cyclical. It's already happened, nothing's new. Everything's the same. History is like nature. It goes in a circle. There's nothing new under the sun, you know. Now, that is simply not the majority of the witness of the Bible. The Bible over and over and over again says that history is not cyclical or in a circle. History is going toward a goal, and that goal is the consummation of history. So I would say that what we have here is either the sarcasm again. Man thinks that life's in a circle, but really it's going toward a target. Man thinks everything has already been, but in reality it hasn't. You see, Jesus never has come before. There's a lot of new things on the sun. So either the professor has a pre-Christian understanding of history. Either he is relying on not the fullness of revelation, but this cyclical view of history is nothing more than Buddhism and Hinduism and Eastern religions. Life just goes on, the wheel of karma, you know. Christianity is totally different from that. Christianity is an arrow down through time that God's accomplishing certain things. Now, in verse 16. Well, the last little phrase in verse 15 is very, 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 very difficult. I would like you to read some of your translations, please, for the last phrase. Living Bible here? Living Bible? Okay. Somebody read it for me real loud. The very last part of verse 15. Maybe the whole verse be better. Okay. That little phrase, God has brought again what is in the distant past. Okay? That's one interpretation. Somebody read the King James for me. God requireth that which is past. Now, what does that mean to you? God requireth that which is past. What would that mean to you? God seeking that which is past? Requires it to be present? Something like that? some of the translation, please. Revised Standard Version. Okay, God seeks what has been driven away. Do you see the difference in this, in King James, about God is searching after the past or living Bible, and this one about God seeking what has been driven away? Okay, New American Standard, somebody. What has passed by, right? What has passed by. Okay, what is this talking about? The commentator that I told you that I like better than anybody else on Ecclesiastes is the commentator Leupold. Leupold says this Hebrew word, and the literal Hebrew word is driven away. So Revised Standard did very well in translating it. It's as far as literal Greek, I mean Hebrew to English. But the ideal here is God seeks the persecuted ones or the pursued ones. Now, if that's the text, that God seeks the persecuted ones, the pursued ones, it's talking about that God is concerned with the weak and the orphan and the widow kind of thing. And that is a true biblical theme. If it means that God is always bringing the past back and putting it in the future, in the present, that fits the context better, doesn't it? The context is what is, has been, what has been, will be. Now that, the way King James translated it and Living Bible, fits the context better, doesn't it? But I really don't know. If I had to choose, I would override context here and go with something like God seeks that which is driven away, and understand that which is driven away is not things but persons. Okay, now, verse 16. Furthermore, I have seen... Key phrase, under the sun. Now we're going to talk about things apart from God. Things as man sees things. Things, the world without the perspective of the spiritual life. The world without the presence of God, okay? That in the place of justice there is wickedness. In the place of righteousness there is wickedness. Now, some folks say this is talking about the same place. This is talking about the law court. I submit to you that I do not think it is talking about the law court solely. It seems to me it's talking about two different places. He looked for justice, that's the law court, and he found wickedness. He looks for righteousness, and that should be the place of piety, the worship scene, the temple, if you please, or something like that, and he found wickedness. What he's saying is, I found wickedness in the government, and I found wickedness in the church. I found wickedness in society, and I found wickedness in the house of God. And that's what I think it's saying. There's wickedness in civil, and there's wickedness in sacred, and the place is just wicked. Okay, now, notice in verse 17, there's going to be two answers to this. There's wickedness in the civil courts, in the civil realm. There's wickedness in the church realm, or the realm of faith. Now, what do you do with that? Number 17, there's two answers to this, okay? Number one, God will judge. God's going to set all things straight. Now, get your thinking cap on with me, okay? I want you to pull this out for yourself. If Coleth is saying God will set things straight, it's implying something very radical for the Old Testament. Do you pick up what it is? If I say any more, I'll tell you what it is. Yes. Okay. And when would this judgment come about? When is this judgment going to be? That's the key. Exactly. Now, in a book in the Old Testament that is very pessimistic about afterlife, we have a strong affirmation that God is going to make things right, not in this life, because there's wickedness in this life where there should have been justice, and there's wickedness where there should have been righteousness. So the only time that God can set it right is when? A future life. Right? Is that a valid implication? I submit to you that because of this implication, many of the writers in the last century have said this verse was added by an editor. They just can't stand to see this in the Old Testament. I want to tell you for sure, that implication is very, very strong here. God's going to set everything right. Well, when's he going to do it? It's got to be after this life. It's got to be the next life. Now, he didn't say what kind of life or all about it. I don't think he knew. But at least he has confidence in God that God is going to set things straight. Things aren't going to be out of balance. The wicked aren't going to prosper, and the righteous aren't going to suffer forever. But God's going to set it straight. And also saying, which I think is a very valid thing, God is going to judge the hearts of men. You know, the New Testament says there's not an idle word spoken that you won't give account of on Judgment Day. Kind of scary, isn't it? Now, verse 18. Answer number two to this is this. And I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see if they are but beasts. Friendly phrase. Now, what's the second answer to this question about wickedness? Number one, God's going to set everything straight eventually. And number two, God has done this. God has allowed wickedness in the place of justice and wickedness in the place of righteousness that he might... Now, the word, Hebrew word here is the word to prove, to test, to analyze. That's a New Testament theme, isn't it? God tested Abraham. Remember that? God tested Jesus. You see, the Holy Spirit's the one who drove Jesus into the temptation experience, not the devil. The Bible teaches that God will test man to see if he's all mouth or if there's more faith to him than just that. And that test will come in the area of your life that means the most to you. God is not testing to destruction, but testing toward the view to approval. God wants to really see if Abraham loves him. Abraham says, I love you, God, and God says, let's see. You see, and all through the Bible, God tests men and women. So I think of the second answer to why is there wickedness in places where it should be justice and in places where it should be righteousness is, God's testing man to see if man is going to be faithful to him in any situation. Now, look at the purpose. The purpose is found, in little words, in order to, for them to see. What is God testing men for them to see? Well, we would think something about salvation or judgment, but the preacher here says God's testing men so they'll know they're just animals. And you don't like that, do you? Now, the Hebrew here doesn't say they're like animals. The Hebrew here says they are beasts. Same word for beast is used in domestic animals. I would translate, they are cows, cattle. Now, let me ask you a question. It's down here, and number five. How is man like the animals? Isn't it a valid perspective that there are some ways in which man and animals are alike? Is that true?
Yeah.
What are some ways? Okay. We all have to, just the physiological parts of our body. We have to eat and digest and excrete, all right? That's normal. That's all animals do that, right? Every animal does that. We reproduce. Every animal does that, right? Now, the context shows that we both die. That's the key, isn't it? Now, what is God trying to show man in these circumstances that God brings man through? Well, I think it's summed up here in the next little thing. I'm going to skip 19 just a second. Go back. Dust to dust. The thing that's common about animals and man is when they die, their bodies go back to dust. And that's one of the curses from man's falling in Genesis. Dust you are, and dust you shall return. And you can put all the embalming things in you want, and it's dust. We go back to the elements. We go back to the very things that are the building blocks of the universe. We go back to those things that God created us in the first place out of, and the animal is just the same. Now, notice in verse 19, for the fates of the son of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Now, this is a proof text for many folks' theology about man doesn't have a soul. Now, just remember the context, and I think you will come out of this tunnel. Notice it says, as one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, all have the same breath. This is the Old Testament word that's used in creation for God breathing into man the breath of life. I remember in Hebrew class, we had to translate the first few chapters of Genesis. Golly. And it was very unusual for me to notice that the Hebrew word that's used for God breathing into man the breath of life is the exact same Hebrew word that's used for God brought animals the breath of life. Same Hebrew word. Matter of fact, let's look back at Genesis 7:22 for a moment. This is a different context. It's talking about the flood experience. But in 7:22, all living creatures are linked together in this idea of God's breath, God's life. Of all that was on the dry land, all in whose nostrils was the breath of the Spirit of life died. What he's saying is, Man died, animals died. Everything on the land drowned. Man and animals drowned. So the breath that was in the animals is the same breath that was in the man, meaning that God is the source of life. Animals have the same source, that's God. The only difference between animals and man is that man knows about God. Man is made in the image of God. But the breath of life is still the gift of God, whether you're an animal or you're a man. Life comes from God. Okay, now, down verse 21. Now, verse 21, I'm going to get real technical with you for a minute, because I bet you every verse in this building I would disagree with, every version that's here. Now, I want somebody to read their versions for me. Well, first of all, does your version in verse 21 have a question mark at the end? How many do not have a question mark? There should be a couple. Vernon, you got RSV? What do you have? You didn't have a question mark at the end of verse 21? You must have erased it. Okay. There is a little, remember, in Hebrew, there is a little article, a little hey, a ha. Can't say it like them, I don't have enough guttural, ha, something. It can mean two things. It can be the article before the noun, or it can be the little particle in their grammar that shows you it's a question. So it can be an interrogative, or it can be an article. Now, most translators of the Bible have made the two ha's in here interrogatives, meaning questions. But Leupold has made them the article before the noun. And so I want to read you how he would change this verse based on the Hebrew grammar. And listen if it makes a difference. First of all, I'm going to take out the question mark. So I'm not talking about a question. I'm making an affirmation. Who knows the breath of man that ascends upward and the breath of beasts that ascends downward on the earth? He makes an affirmation. They say, well, this is radical. The Old Testament knows nothing about the spirit of man going upward and the spirit of beast going downward. Well, I don't believe that. Let's just flip over, if we could, to chapter 12 of Ecclesiastes, verse 7. Chapter 12, verse 7. Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it. Now, either chapter 12, verse 7 is an editor adding something to the text, and I want to say right here, I get real nervous with editors adding something to the text. So I think that they can't say that this is something that's not Old Testament understanding, that Koheleth didn't believe in life or death, and this was an untrue affirmation. When in chapter 12, verse 7, the same book, it says the exact same thing, that man's soul go back to God. Now, if we try to read in this, all of our New Testament understanding of when a man dies, he goes to be with the Lord, then we've missed the whole thing that Koheleth is saying. Koheleth didn't say a whole lot about life or death. He's not saying where or how or why or how long or when. But he is saying that man is made in the image of God, and that man's spirit somehow goes back to God, and that animals are different and their spirit goes back to the earth. Now, he's not saying a whole lot more than that. If I could paraphrase what he's trying to say, because he's a Hebrew man, he knows the Old Testament. He's saying man is made in the image of God, and whatever the image of God means or is will go back to the Lord. Animals are not made in the image of God. When they die, they just die. Now, I've changed the question there. But I think because of 12:7, and because of this little H in Hebrew, looks like a little house with a top on it, can mean either an interrogative or an article. And because the article fits very well in the grammar, I'm going to change every English translation and say, I think it's an affirmation and not a question. And you may want to put that in the side. If it is a question, we've got the greatest pessimism in all the world. If it's a question, it goes something like this. Who knows that the breath of man ascends upwards, or the breast of beast ascends downwards on the earth? Now, even if it is a question, now think with me, get your thinking caps on. Even if it is a question, he's using as a foil something he heard somewhere. I mean, how did he even think about the spirit of man going up and the spirit of animals going down if he hadn't heard that somewhere? How is he reacting against something, even if it is a question, that no Old Testament person thought about? So you see, even if we leave the question there, somewhere he's reacting against what he heard, that man's spirit goes up. Or he's saying, that can't be right. Who knows that's true? But he had to hear it somewhere to even think that thought. You see what I'm saying? So I would take the question out and I would make it an affirmation of faith instead of a question of doubt. That's the whole thing. I'm changing it from a question of a doubting mind to the affirmation of an inspired writer. And I don't think I'm totally destroying the context. Now look at verse 22, summary of all chapter 3. And I have seen that nothing is better than that man should be happy in his activities, for this is his lot. For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? This is the summary thing. It's going ahead. Over. What's good for man? For man to recognize there is a God in heaven that does have a plan for his life, that's kept man from knowing all that man would like to know, and man's best bet in life is to be happy where he is, love God, do good, serve man, and let leave the rest on the sovereign God. Now, the last little part, For who will bring him to see what will occur after him? Now, this is not talking about afterlife. Don't read too much in the Old Testament. This is not talking about after him, meaning what, who will come, and what about the afterlife, what about heaven, what about the city of God and all that. I think it's saying he won't know what's happening on the earth. I mean, he won't know the process of events that follow his death. He will understand the development of mankind. He will understand progressive revelation, because when he dies, as far as the events of earth are concerned, that's it. I disagree totally with the fact that our loved ones look over heaven's rail and see what we're doing. I think the ones in the Lord who have gone before us are at this moment unconscious of things that are happening on the earth. So, questions, conclusions, affirmations, assumptions. Yes. Right, and I think that's the purpose of God in this whole thing here. I think that was what was bugging this guy. He's saying, God has put in me the drive to know, but God has closed the door to the library. God has put me the terrible desire to know what's going to happen, to plan my life, to guide my destiny. But God has determined my life. So I think that's real true. This word means to prove, to purify, to test. Do you think God tests you? You better believe he does. Yes, sir. And some are pretty severe. Some of them come out of the context of he won't let his child get away from him. Hebrews says, those he loves, he chastens. And he chastens them not because he just likes to spank everybody, but to make them what he wants them to be. That's what the test is. God molding man into the image of Christ, even Old Testament man. Anybody? Comments? Do you see how really depressing this book would get if we hadn't talked about the purpose of this book ahead of time? If we'd have just read this like straight theology, just read it like, say, read it like Romans, do you know what kind of understanding of God we'd have? Understanding of man? This book, if it's straight theology, is a total antithesis to every affirmation the rest of the Bible makes. And I don't believe it'd be in the inspired Word of God if it was that. So it's got to be this tongue-in-cheek, sarcasm, man without God perspective. If you miss that, boy, this book is the pits.